And this morning, Dave Millard is with us, representative of the 109th District, with his monthly report on what's going on in the world today. Now, we were talking about French fries.
Yes.
Mr. Millard, your favorite fry?
Grossest French fries.
Okay. Can you get Grossest French fries outside of fair time?
Yes, they travel around throughout the summer to other events.
Yeah, but it's not like they have like a location where they can go to get it, like a McDonald's and something like that.
You just have to go on their website and see where they're at.
Because the top three French fries, Chick-fil-A in at number three, Five Guys, and of course McDonald's is number one. But did you know?
What did I know?
Did you know that there are seven ingredients in a McDonald's French fry?
Potatoes.
Yes, that's one.
Oil.
Yes, vegetable oil, that's two.
Salt.
Yes, salt is three.
Something like a sodium bisulfite to preserve them.
Beef flavor. They put in beef flavor.
Sure.
Citric acid and dextrose.
Right.
I don't know what that sugar. Other stuff is. Is that what that is?
Yeah.
Sugar? Dextrose is sugar?
Mm-hmm.
I thought they had sugar in those. Makes them.
Well, to coat them with a little sugar to help them caramelize.
You know, that, you know. Okay, here.
Ooh, I have a first question.
Well, I'm not asking a question. Let me.
I have a question of Dave.
All right. Yeah, but we have
email. We get email.
Rats.
We get your email every day. Here's your mail today.
And this
Joe?
Is Dave.
Joe?
No, Dave.
This Dave.
This is an email to Dave Millard.
Well, do the sounder again, and then I'll say Dave.
Dave, I'm writing to ask you to please end the budget stalemate. The people of Pennsylvania sent a message to the PA legislators last November that they do not mind a tax increase to pay for the new budget. Governor Wolf ran with the platform that the state needed to raise sales taxes and wage taxes to pay for the spending that the previous governor passed without the means to fund it. The people voted him into office, and his agenda must be met. The Republican majority has stalled long enough over this. It is time to compromise on the tax and spending and get the budget passed. There should be no adjournment of the House or Senate until there is an agreement.
Is it signed?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to give the name. It's a Catawissa voter, okay?
Okay, there we go.
However, who was the governor before Corbett?
Ed Rendell.
What was his nickname?
Spendell.
Spendell. There
right.
you go. And I told you, Corbett rode a dark horse all 4 years he was there. First of all, for the mess that was left to him by Rendell when he came in, did not raise taxes, on-time budget 4 times, on-time budget 5 times. This year, on-time budget passed in the House of Representatives, presented to the governor, passed the House, passed the Senate, presented to the governor. Within 45 minutes, he vetoed the whole thing. Not line by line, a veto, all-encompassing veto of the whole package. So for that gentleman there to say that the Republicans are holding it up, absolutely not. The Republicans presented an on-time budget. And when the governor's budget was proposed, after he vetoed the Republican proposal from the House and the Senate, not even one Democratic vote for that budget. So that letter is in error. That letter is in error. The people did not elect Wolf to raise your taxes. I haven't heard but from just one sector of employment to favor his tax and spend proposal.
Well, he certainly was open about the fact that he was going to spend more money during his campaign.
There's no question.
So the writer is correct in the fact that nobody in the majority of the people of the state voted for Governor Wolf, and nobody who paid any attention thought that that wasn't going to include higher taxes along the line to pass what he was talking about.
Listen, I've got a 176-page document right here.
Right.
You see what it says, critical vote analysis.
Right.
This was everything that the governor proposed and was voted on, and page after page after page, it was defeated.
Right.
Not a single vote.
Well, I understand
that. So you may say that he campaigned on it. You're correct on that. But I don't take that as a mandate for raising the PIT, for increasing the sales tax, or the base of items to be taxed. I haven't heard from but one employed sector to do that. And the only ones that have supported it so far by profession was education. And I will not support a major tax increase.
Well, you know, I think where the governor is going wrong, and I do think the governor is going wrong, is he needs to take a page out of Ed Rendell's playbook, which is pick the most important thing out of the list of things that you feel that you want to accomplish in your 4 years as governor, because it's only going to be 4 years.
Oh, the 80-20 principle.
And pick the most important thing and push it through. Compromise it through. You know, Ed Rendell came to office and said, we're going to get new stadiums in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh, and we're going to get casino gambling. And he knew that, you know, gaming from day one, and if you remember way back when, gaming in this state started just as slot machines.
Right.
But Ed Rendell knew that before he left office, there was going to be table games. But he knew that the legislature wasn't going to swallow table games, you know, encompassing gambling in one fell swoop. So he gave him, had him take half a teaspoon, start with, and we see that, you know, that it's not going to be a disaster, that we can control the gaming, and then we'll introduce table games as part two.
One bite at a time,
right.
And I get that. Now, here's the deal now. In September, the October revenue report, and I don't have the report for October itself, that will come probably tomorrow or on Monday. But we brought in $2.73 billion in revenue collections. So my point is that for Governor Wolf to do an all-encompassing veto of the whole package, there's no need to do that. Dollars are there for our crisis centers. Dollars are there for our senior centers. Dollars are there that we wouldn't have to necessitate our counties to go out and borrow money,
right,
to provide services in our community. Listen, 271 items out of 400 and some, 401 or 404 items, agreed to.
Yeah.
Why would you, as Governor Mayo, why would you veto a whole package when you agree on 270 items? You wouldn't do that.
Well, because I probably wouldn't, but I think you're losing leverage if you allow those others to pass. I'm assuming his feeling is he needs the leverage of the entire budget being held up to push through the things that are not. You know, my question is, or my reality is, as a voter, the insanity, you're collecting the money. You know, the state is still collecting the money. The insanity that the state has got this money that they're getting, you know, 1% if they're lucky, you know, 1 or 1.25% sitting in the bank, and yet they're making these school districts and other businesses go out and borrow money that they now say they're not going to reimburse them, and I'm hearing that these people, you know, that the interest rate isn't the 1.5 or 2% I thought it would be. It's the 3+% interest they're paying on borrowing this money, which is raising the cost of their doing business by 3% or running their organizations by 3%. This is, you know, you got a loan. Why aren't they loaning the money to these districts that desperately need the money? I mean, because this is only making the banks wealthy. This is insanity. It's the definition of insanity at this point.
And I just got a report yesterday on the 500 school districts with the time frame who already ran out of money or had to borrow.
Right.
And who's preparing anticipation notes to bring revenue in. But yesterday, to conclude this thing on the budget, we know that it hasn't been passed. You know, my regrets to, you know, the listening audience that we don't have it done. The Senate tried a stopgap veto override yesterday, and it failed. All along party lines. So we're trying everything that we can do to get through this terrible, terrible impasse. But, you know, it all comes down to one guy, one signature. Mm-hmm. And if he doesn't sign off on it, then that's where the phone calls need to be directed. End of story.
All right.
I don't disagree. I mean, this isn't working the way it is. And the insanity of it is the money is there. And so, you know, you gotta negotiate. We supposedly as a country always talk about the thing we do best. We're willing to compromise and negotiate. But it doesn't seem to me that there's any compromising. And there might be negotiating going on. But it's not negotiating when you're not willing. You know, you look at these teacher strikes that get settled. And Danville's a good instance. Millville is another one. You know, at the end of the day, when you look at what kept them apart for years, it's so minuscule as to you think to yourself, I mean, you really could not have sat down 3 years ago and made this work, because at the end of the day, the differences are literally minuscule.
Is this Wolf's lack of political savvy that has got him into this position? That he's kind of backed himself into a corner, hasn't he?
Well,
in
listen,
a way,
I've had some great conversations with the governor more than once, and I think that he is an idealist, that he wants to accomplish good for the Commonwealth. But I think he's getting bad advice from his advisors. I don't think that you advise somebody who's got two-thirds or close to three-quarter of what they've asked for in a budget proposal to veto the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. So he's getting bad advice.
Oh, there's no question.
And that's lack of political savvy.
Yeah. Katie McGinty, she's on to other races and everything else. She was there for a while. John Hanger is there, former guy from Penn Future, and you know all the environmental business and DEP and all that stuff, and now he's his advisor. And I've been on appropriations for over a decade, and when we've had different individuals come before us, you know, you through questioning when you're there for 8, 10, 12 hours a day, and that's what it is. Maybe not with every single department that comes in, but your larger ones, they're there for hours. And I can tell you that there are a variety of personalities that I've seen, people that I felt you can work with and people that I thought I wouldn't want to work for. Mm-hmm. And he's got a couple of those people there right now.
I thought maybe his business background would bring some reality to this thing. Well, you know what I mean?
I think he does have a good business background. And I think that,
well, he's not carrying on a good business practice here.
He when you're in charge, when you're the top person in charge, what's going to happen here politically? Now, this is just Dave Millard speaking. I think what's going to happen politically is he's going to shut himself out of this over time. He's going to isolate himself from being at the bargaining table. He might be sitting at the table, but nobody's going to listen. This is going to be all decided by the people that are going to vote on it and have the votes to do an override of a veto. It's going to be decided by the leadership on both sides of the aisle in the Senate and the House, and the governor is going to be left out. He's going to be force-fed something that he may not want.
Well, that's what I meant when I said painting himself in a corner. He can't get out.
But the Republicans are not, you don't see right now where the Democrats are getting ready to jump ship and give you enough votes for the override.
Mm-hmm. Well, I won't get into private conversations I've had, but there's not harmony, let's put it that way.
Because in the Senate, you only need like three votes to override, don't you? And you don't have even the three at this point.
Not at this point. So we'll see how next Tuesday changes things. But in the meantime, we are working on other pieces of interest here in the Commonwealth. We worked on mandatory minimum sentencing requirements for violent crimes and for violent crimes committed with firearms. Setting up minimum sentences for people who commit acts that involve a firearm and people who commit other acts. In other words, one of the big topics of discussion was drugs and the amount of drugs that you would have that would determine when a minimum sentence would kick in, and all those details. It's rather lengthy, but just to let you know that we are working on other things. We worked on expungement of criminal history record this week. We did sentences for, I told you, offenses committed with firearms. We worked on municipal pension plan funding standards for our local municipalities, 33 of which are here in Columbia County. Statewide, there's well over 1,000. So, they're, very important pieces of legislation that are being crafted in addition to trying to work on.
So there have not been minimum sentencing guidelines for crimes?
There were, but what they've done is go into retweak it, we'll call it that, to add, some other elements involved in it. So
you might be able to answer a question for me about how... how government works from the standpoint of, for the last 5 years now or more, there's been the talk of doing away or modifying the state liquor system and privatizing it.
There's still a big talk about that at the negotiating table.
At the present time, the wine and spirits store in Columbia County, the one out on Route 11, is getting ready to move to the new Staples Dillon Center
strip mall
where Giant is. How, if there's talk about privatizing the liquor store, did someone sign, I'm assuming, a long-term lease for a piece of property? I mean, I can't believe that building was built without the thought that the liquor store would be at that spot for some extended period of time. Where didn't somebody say we're not negotiating new leases if we're going to be doing away with the liquor system?
Well, I'm sure that a new lease was signed. Now, the details of which I wouldn't have. However, any legislation that would deal with privatization would honor existing leases.
Right.
So there's your answer.
Well,
right,
but you're tying up. So you're making privatizing the system become more expensive if you're committing yourself to a long-term lease, when at the same time you're talking about getting out of the liquor business.
But it's not law yet. It's a thought process. It's a concept, a law that's being discussed.
Right.
But it hasn't been passed and signed by the governor. So therefore, the liquor stores are operating status quo as they normally do.
Operating, we used to have an old saying back in the when there was a lot of buying and selling of radio stations, and that is act as if we're going to own the radio station the rest of our lives.
Right.
And that's how they have to do. They're going to sign leases, and they're going to act as if the state's going to own these things hitherto forth.
Yeah, but you're operating, the state's talking about getting out of operating. The radio station is going to continue to operate. You know,
the liquor store is going to continue.
Yeah, but
to operate.
not necessarily in that location.
Well, they can make a business decision and say we're going to pay off that lease and we're going to move to a location that fits our needs as an independent business owner that happens to have a liquor store license. No.
I know. I mean, I think you can look at it if I would run the Pine Barn till, as I always would think the Pine Barn should be run, and if it's sold, assuming that somebody who bought it would continue to run it as a restaurant. But where you're selling the liquor store, you're not necessarily assuring that somebody's going to continue to run a liquor store in that location.
Well, that's true, but until the lease expires.
Right. Well, it could be. My guess is it's a business like that's probably a 10-year lease.
Well, what are they going to do? Sit around and not sign a lease? Re-up a lease?
Why, they don't have to leave where they are.
I don't know if they have to or not.
Well, and I'm sure that entering into this new location, there was probably consideration given to increased foot traffic, different product presentation. I mean, I don't know, but from a marketing standpoint, you want to sell the max of what you can.
There are
product.
Two areas on Route 11 that I think are the most dangerous areas, and that is getting into Dunkin' Donuts.
Right. Yep.
I mean to tell you, I have seen more near serious accidents there and people coming in and out of that stupid state store where the parking is abysmal, and particularly like on Homecoming. I mean to tell you, I'm surprised there weren't more accidents out there.
Right. Right,
the Dunkin' Donuts is like George trying to get the Frogger machine across the street in Seinfeld.
You get these
idiots. Horrible.
Yeah, you know, and there's traffic up coming from both ways, and they start you know, playing chicken with one another.
And you know the only place it's worse? Getting in and out of the Dunkin' Donuts in Danville.
That's bad
just
too, yeah.
Oh, it's in a back alley, and you can't get your car turned far enough to look to see if cars are coming up off Route 11. Other than the volume of traffic isn't quite as much, it's horrible. Just horrible.
They should close that drive-through there.
Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah, sure.
Well, then they would be out of business.
No, they wouldn't be out of business.
Well, people aren't getting, we're fat and lazy as Americans. They ain't getting out of their car.
Thank you, Dave Millard, for joining us in this very compelling interview here at News Radio WHLM.
News Radio WHLM. Local news you don't have to reboot. WHLM.